Sierra has all the best active and outdoor brands for the super athletic stuff, like running gear for cruising up the trail.
Woo!
And the super athlete-ish stuff, like fishing gear for chilling by the creek. Nice cast. Fitness apparel to push for higher reps. You got this. And golf balls priced so you can afford to lose one. Or a few. Head to Sierra or Sierra.com for the brands you want at the prices that let you do it all. From athletic to athlete-ish, Sierra's got it.
Study.
And play. Come together on a Windows 11 PC.
And for a limited time, college students get
the best of both worlds.
Get the Unreal College Deal. Everything you need to study and play with select Windows 11 PCs. Eligible students get a year of Microsoft 365 Premium and a year of Xbox Game Pass Ultimate with a custom color Xbox wireless controller. Learn more at windows.com/student offer. While supplies last, ends June 30th. Terms at aka.ms/college PC.
That's enough of that, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Candidate Corner, a subsection of the Bituation Room. On and off again, little subsection. There are so many candidates, so many corners, you know, you can't be in them all. So, you know, we just save these interviews for very special candidates. And boy, oh boy, do I have a special candidate. Someone who, you know what? Someone who's going to whip the squad into shape. Let's just be real. Someone who's going to like organize a squad when they get to Congress, you know? Someone who's going to organize the Congressional Progressive Caucus. I'm putting this all on them. But get excited, especially those of you who are in New York. She's a labor organizer, a Democratic socialist. She has been a New York State Assembly member representing neighborhoods in Queens, also endorsed by current Mayor Zohran Mamdani, Bernie Sanders of Bernie Sanders fame, the Sunrise Movement, and so many more. Please welcome Claire Valdez.
Oh my gosh. Hi. Good to be here.
Good to have you here. I do the stand-up intro, but there's no like audience clapter. So it's always a little
for ourselves.
Weird.
It's fine. All good.
Welcome. Look, you are in the middle of your, you know, your campaign right now. It's a really exciting time. I know you guys are knocking doors. I just have a question for you because, look, I'm seeing you on paper. I'm looking at your record. I'm looking at the things you've done. I'm seeing that you're running on a platform of making it easier to form a union, defending workers' rights, Medicare for all, winning a Green New Deal, housing for all, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But is there any position that you have that's like unpopular?
It's a great question. And, you know, we should all be very proud that these are popular opinions now because it's taken
like,
a long
but you got to have a bad opinion. Like, what's your least popular opinion? Like, are you on Clay Thompson's side in the Meg Thee Stallion v. Clay Thompson breakup?
My hot take is we need to abolish pre-check. I've got like a million beefs with the airline industry and the process of having to fly. We need to like nationalize the airline industry. But let's start abolishing pre-check.
I'm sorry. My heart just like I honestly like could cry a little bit. I'm getting very emotional by you saying, yeah. Oh my God. Because, well, no, in a good way, because I have pre-check. I'm definitely a pre-check babe, but I agree with you about nationalizing it and the fact that, you know, I mean, we're in this weird moment where like we're defending TSA workers who have still been going without pay, as far as I know, which is insane. You know, they're like getting second jobs and, you know, their union is being undermined. And so somehow we, and I know you were politicized under the so-called war on terror. Okay. We're like in this new realm where we're like defending TSA workers because their rights are being trampled.
Yeah, absolutely. And all the while, you know, like airline industry is making a lot of money, and constantly undermining, you know, consumer rights, nickel and diming us in every single facet of, you know, having to fly someplace. And in a country where there's no robust national rail system, all we have are, you know, it's only, it's planes or nothing if we want to get from one side of the country to the other. And so we're forced into these like super uncomfortable seats. We have very few rights. Yep. Airline industry, they overbook flights. There are all kinds of ways that they're making sure they're making the maximum profit at our discomfort, inconvenience, and great expense too. It is so expensive to fly. And you're right, TSA agents are being undermined right now. The union's being undermined by this administration. And it's a really shameful situation that we find ourselves in. And we're really, for now, at least we're stuck with it. But I think we need to organize for a better future where our airline industry is nationalized.
This is where you socialists, you know, you start to talk all this, you know, all these ideas that really appeal to everyone. And I just feel like, you know, the Democratic Party would frown on that. You know, I mean, these ideas are a little too relatable to all voters. But when you're talking about this, and I just introduced you as a Democratic socialist, you're talking about airlines, you're talking about, you know, these long lines. This is something that affects everyone. And I'm immediately reminded of like Zoran Mamdani filling potholes mm-hmm. and, you know, putting people to work for $30 an hour to, you know, shovel snow during your really, really hellish winter. I mean, it is really amazing that kind of some of the leaders like yourself that we're seeing who identify as Democratic Socialists are also people who aren't afraid to kind of speak directly to people's everyday grievances, and specifically grievances with corporate overlords and corporate power structures like the airline industry.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, I got involved in politics because of my union, but also because, like, I was pissed off. You know, our wages aren't going up. Our rent is going up. Our utility bills are going up. Everything about our lives is getting much more expensive. And we have so little control over any of that. You know, I became a Democratic Socialist because I saw the power that my union could win when we organized just everyday working people coming together and saying, actually, we're the ones who make, I worked at Columbia University. We're the ones who make this university run. We're the ones who have made this a very profitable institution. Where's our kickback on this? Like, why are we struggling to make rent? Why are we struggling to, you know, commute in from other states? Because, you know, a lot of my union members couldn't even afford to live in New York City. They're living in Pennsylvania or New Jersey. It's unacceptable. And when we organize, we can demand better wages, better working conditions, all those things. But it starts from this position of just like, what is going on? Why do these corporations have so much power over our lives? And why are we really struggling to get by?
I think that your experience, I know you were, you know, maybe politicized during the Iraq War, but that actually sort of taking your politics and applying them in the union context was really transformative. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as someone who's not been part of a union, sadly, I mean, you know, when I organized the first YouTubers union, you know, holler, help me. But
let's do it.
It is such a transformative experience to be part of a union, to win a contract, to win the vote, to win negotiate a contract, win the contract. Like, tell me about how critical that is and like what that did for your brain and how you sort of viewed politics.
Yeah, totally. I mean, like so many Americans, I've worked a lot of bad jobs. I did customer service stuff. I worked at Taco Bell. I worked at Trader Joe's for a long time. You know, I scraped by. And throughout the whole time, I really just thought, this is the way it is. I just need to get through the next shift and the next shift after that. And this is my life. The union really showed me that, like, I remember, like, the first day on the job, my boss came over and was like, all right, well, you get a 1-hour lunch break. And I was just like, well, where do I go? What do you mean? I have, like, I just leave my desk now and I go someplace else and have lunch. Like, it's such a basic dignity that so few workers have access to. And it really just changed everything about my life, like the living wage and really the time off, the control that you have over your life. You clock out at 5 o'clock, and if they want you to stay late, that's overtime. Okay, pay up. And so few workers have that experience. And it was absolutely transformational for me. I got to negotiate on our bargaining committee when we were negotiating our contract, and sitting across the table from management as an equal. Wow. Like, so, yes. Like, who gets, so few people get to do that. And what
it's
you
like
find-
economic therapy. You know, it's funny because like I haven't been at a bargaining table, but I have been in therapy, with, you know, like, but, and in like, I've been in therapy with family members and all this. And it's like, it is just like, oh, this is a moment where we just talk about stuff. We can talk about it and we can have a better arrangement coming out of this. Perfect. Yeah. We need this therapy because I make this place run. You make this place run. But enough about my marriage, Claire. I sort of facetiously said, you know, Congress needs a union organizer, but I'm actually kind of serious about that. You know, if elected to New York 7th, which I hope I clarified, New York 7th, tell us what New York 7th is because it's huge and it's very, very blue. And then we'll talk about the union stuff.
Yeah, totally. It's a big district. So it's Western Queens and Northern Brooklyn. Put it on the map. It's a bunch of different neighborhoods from Greenpoint, Williamsburg, Bushwick, all the way down to, you know, East New York and Cypress Hills, and on the Queens side, Astoria, all the way through, you know, Woodhaven. It's huge. But within that district, it is deep, deep blue. It voted overwhelmingly for Mayor Mamdani in last year's mayoral primary. Let's go. And it's a very diverse district, economically, racially. It's a district made up of immigrants. It has almost more artists than any other district in the country. So a deeply vibrant and creative district as well. It's a really incredible place. It deserves a representative who's going to, you know, bring that voice to Congress.
A lot of my friends are in this district. I think the other thing that when you talk about artists and immigrants, and I also know it's a place that's very, you know, the rent is crazy and it's a place that's hard to, you know, scrape by.
Yeah, absolutely.
Issues around housing, issues around Medicare for all. I mean, as a podcaster slash comic slash whatever, I can't tell you, as someone who buys my health insurance on the marketplace, what a Medicare for all system would do, you know, for my life.
Totally.
And for so many people who are like me, kind of like piecing together, you know, a salary and a work situation. But in terms of Congress, like, what's that union energy that you would hope to bring if and when elected?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're right that I think we need organizers in Congress because, you know, this idea that one politician can do everything by themselves is just not true. We know it's not true. We need people who will work with their colleagues, find points of agreement, and really try and move together. I'm in the New York State Assembly right now. I'm really lucky that I'm with other socialists in office. We coordinate all the time. We strategize together. We share information. And there's so much more power when you can move together, when you can think strategically together. And that's how you push back against, you know, lobbyists who have immense power. You can push back against, you know, special interests that are flooding money into these races. Being with other people who share a vision for the society we all deserve, that's enormous. And that's what I hope to do in Congress too. It's a big feat. It's a big body, a lot of people. And obviously the needs right now, the scale of crisis that people are experiencing, it's really daunting. But I think when we organize together, this is exactly how we win.
And I think more than that, you know, I see the way that some, you know, Congress people treat their seat as just kind of like an ego trip, like a platform to launch a podcast off of. And it's like, hi, I'm the podcaster. Thank you very much. But, you know, it is very much, I think running for office involves a certain amount of ego, but you are an elected official. You are working for the people. Okay. And so it's nice to see someone in office who's like, no, I'm going to like move the chessboard pieces to get, you know, across the finish line, to mix metaphors, like, you know, to get something done versus, you know, sort of plant my flag. I mean, look, as much as I love having shit stirrers in Congress, I am more concerned about a shit stirrer that can also get it done. And I think your union background, it really shows that, like, okay, no matter what, I'm sure you had workers at the UAW who were working with you who you didn't politically agree with on everything, but you guys had a goal. Yep. And so it was like, okay, this is our goal. And how are we going to get that? How are we going to stop weapons to Israel, as I know you firmly believe in?
Yeah, absolutely. No, and I think that's right. And I think the other thing I would say too is being an organizer means organizing not just within the halls of power, but staying connected to the organizations and movements on the outside too. Being able to share strategy and information and think through the big questions of how do we advance a politics of a foreign policy of peace and global cooperation? How do we end aid to Israel? How do we end the genocide in Gaza and forever wars? Like, that can't also, you know, Congress alone can't do that. We need like a real thriving anti-war movement on the outside to push us, to hold us accountable. Both pieces are so necessary.
Absolutely. Let me ask you about like the people in Congress right now. You know, and I want to talk to you about two pieces of legislation that you talk about often, which is the PRO Act, you know, making it easier to unionize, but also a bunch of stuff that like I'm not totally versed on. And you know, let's talk about the PRO Act a little bit. We're in a moment where you have a lot of Republicans whose votes you're inevitably likely going to need, who like to kind of peacock as populists. They like to do a lot of lip service about being for working class people. But when it comes to things like the PRO Act, and look, Democrats are guilty of this as well, you know, they're like, I'm not going to vote for that. You know, you've got senators like Josh Hawley who, you know, have these very long screeds about how, you know, we have to support workers and da da da. It's all couched in like Christian nationalist, like family, you know, shit. But like, there is sort of lip service. How do you, you know, tell me about trying to get something like the PRO Act, like across the finish line and like, you know, trying to, you know, how do you lobby them? How do you get them over to your side on this one?
Yeah, totally. And this is exactly where, you know, having a thriving movement on the outside is where this is will be so essential. The last time there was a really big push around the PRO Act was in 2021. There were a huge national phone banks that helped push some people like Angus King to flip his vote. So a movement on the outside is really, really important. And we need the labor movement to really rally around this point. The PRO Act would make it easier to organize, and particularly in place, it would abolish right to work. It would end captive audience meetings. And we have a lot of these protections in New York State already, but in places in the South, it's incredibly hard to organize your shop. Workers face immense pressure, and it's a real uphill battle. And we have to level the playing field on this. The way we win, in my opinion, things like Medicare for All and real investments in our housing is by having people who are ready to know how to organize, who are ready to organize. And that is the labor movement, baby. Like, that's how we do it. So getting as many people as possible into unions, that's goal number one. And we need the labor movement to help us out in this.
Let me ask you a little like a sort of chicken or the egg question when it comes to Medicare for All and like labor rights, because sometimes, you know, you see, obviously one of the big things that unions will organize for in their new contracts is health plans, better health plan, change of health plan, whatever it is. And that's a really big piece of like what makes unions tick. And like, again, not all unions, I would say, are, you know, lefty or progressive or whatever. But how do you feel like that clashes with the broader push for Medicare for All? Or how do we leverage union power into a fight for Medicare for All, you know, knowing that like, should this be off the table in terms of the bargaining table, it would be so much easier for these unions, you know, to get to other issues as well. They wouldn't just be sticking on, you know, healthcare would be taken care of by, yes, the federal government and federal investments.
Yeah, totally. And this is a real tension within the labor movement too. You know, we talk about it like this, it's this monolith, but you know, it's not. And there's always disagreement and tensions. But what you said is exactly right. You know, my union, UAW, has supported Medicare for All and at the state level, the New York Health Act, precisely because it takes this off the table. And I know from negotiating the contract at Columbia University that the first thing they go after is our healthcare. The first thing they say is, well, union members don't pay premiums. Everyone else does. It's not fair. You need to pay in. And we'll start with $5 a month. And of course, we're going to ratchet that up to $500 as soon as we possibly can. But it's the first thing they go after. If we take that off the table, we can negotiate better childcare benefits. We can negotiate for other things. We can expand our horizons for what we can demand. But it's always the first thing that companies go after. And it's this thing that really stifles unionizing too. You know, if you are tied to your job, because if you leave, you know, you won't get the quality of healthcare that you need. What are you going to do? You're going to stay stuck. If workers have more freedom, more flexibility, can feel like they can stick their necks out a little bit, that makes organizing easier for everyone. And so it's really essential that we pass Medicare for All.
Absolutely. I totally agree. And, you know, there's another piece of this, and I feel like Democrats haven't led on it when it comes to workers' rights, is immigration, mm-hmm. right? And immigrant rights. As immigrants are, you know, driven into the shadows even more so by, you know, the policies of ICE. I know you believe in abolishing ICE, but how do you take a pro-immigrant stand? How do you envision that? How have you done that maybe in your political career? And how does that sort of work with your stance around workers' rights and the right to unionize?
Yeah, totally. So at the state level, we're fighting for some legislation that would certainly make things easier for our immigrant neighbors to feel safer here. Ultimately, the fight is at the federal level. We do have to abolish ICE. I and some other colleagues were arrested last year at 26 Federal Plaza because we were trying to see the conditions on the 10th floor, where we know so many of our constituents have been held for, you know, days, maybe weeks, in really inhumane, disgusting conditions. I've done court watching. I've walked past ICE agents who laughed at us, who think that this is a funny. It's like the inhumanity is it's almost unspeakable. And this is what this federal administration has propped up, but this agency has existed for decades now. And it has to be, we have to end it. There's no purpose now for this agency that is now militarized, that's not just murdering American citizens in broad daylight, but it's murdering immigrants behind closed doors. Yes. It has to be abolished. And when we stand up for immigrant neighbors, you know, it's directly tied to workers' rights too. So many work sites are being busted by ICE because they, you know, because bosses suck. Because bosses know suck. That if they threaten their workers with deportation, they can keep wages low, they can keep working conditions unsafe, they can skim off as much money as they can from people who are incredibly yes. vulnerable to predation. And that has to stop. The labor movement teaches us that solidarity is our greatest strength. And then when we link arms with our immigrant neighbors, we have so much power. And that's really the vision that we're fighting for. It's against these bosses that are trying to make our lives terrible, that are trying to nickel and dime us at every single step, these corporations that have made our lives even worse, and that we can advance a really affordable and solidaristic future that keeps everyone safe and makes our lives beautiful.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we're at this point where, and I'm assuming, you know, if elected, we advancing like real immigration reform is part of that. I mean, to me, it's like, I mean, you know, I dream of amnesty, but hey, I also feel like we cannot wait for that immigration reform to say no worker, no matter their status, should have wages stolen from them if Absolutely. They're doing a job. I mean, you see that, you know, contractors calling ICE on their fucking Yep. workers so they don't have to pay them. I mean, Yep. reals, like things that you're referencing too, using ICE as another way to, yeah, tame the workforce. Mm-hmm. And I think it's like, yes, immigration reform, yes, a change, but like also we can implement those protections now.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think we can't talk about immigration without talking about the reasons that people come to this country too, and the role that the United States has played in environmental devastation, in sanctions, in forever wars that have driven people as refugees to this country. You know, I think that this has to be part of the conversation as we talk about making sure that people who are here can stay here for the long haul. And my cat has now made an appearance. Forgive me. I'm going to try to get him out of here.
Please show. Please. Where is he? Oh my God. Is it a white cat?
It's a white cat. He'll pop back up again.
He's like, I'm cute.
He's like, forever wars. Let's talk about it.
Does he have like, I feel like he's one of those cats that has like one green eye and one blue eye.
No, he's got two yellow eyes.
Oh my God. I was hoping for like a Dr. Quinn medicine woman eye, but like, yeah, let's see. I think something someone people are thinking about where we're like, wait a minute, who's Claire running against? Who? Well, first of all, let's talk about the fact that Nydia Velazquez, who has held this seat since 2013, is doing something kind of insane for a congressperson, which is she's resigning. Mm-hmm. She is gracefully resigning. And tell me what the impact of her tenure has been on the district. Do you hope to continue it? How do you hope to change it, if at all? Give me your reflections and then tell me who you're up against now.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I'm in a really rare position where I can say that my congressperson is incredible. That's not a widespread feeling enough in this country, but Congressman Velazquez has been standing up for immigrants and small businesses for her entire career, and been a real voice for the people in Puerto Rico who do not have congressional representation. And I'll say that just personally, you know, she was one of the first Congress members who called for a ceasefire in 2023. And that came at a moment when it was like politically not an easy thing to do, but it comes from her deep commitment to international solidarity. And I have the world of admiration for her. I think she's done an incredible job. And, you know, I would be so lucky to follow in her incredibly, incredibly big shoes. Right now, the race is between myself, Brooklyn Borough President Antonio Reynoso, City Councilmember Julie Wan, and public defender Vikal Kumar. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of a crowded race. There's all open seats tend to be. Oh, my cat just
and there's
off
no
the table.
A crowded race, a crowded table, and there is no ranked choice, of course.
No ranked choice in this case, in this race. Nope.
Are we doing, is it a jungle primary to November?
No, it'll be a Democratic primary in June and then a general in November. But this is, again, such a deep blue progressive district. It'll be, the primary is the real fight.
Why do you feel like your candidacy stands out from the rest?
You know, I think we are in a moment when unions are so, so popular in the United States. Very few people feel that they can actually join one or organize one. And having a labor union member do that work and come from a bargaining committee, come from her shop, I think that that's a really powerful thing that we need in Congress. You know, I'm the only candidate in this race who's not taking money from real estate amidst a housing crisis when, as you said, this is a district that's overwhelmingly tenants. It's 77% tenants in this district. People live, you know, every month struggling to get to that next rent check. And there's been a long history of displacement and development that's made it very expensive to live here. And I think we need someone who will really stand with tenants in this moment. Yeah. And I'll also say, the genocide in Gaza is the great moral question of our time. And I've been organizing for a ceasefire, for an arms embargo for the last 2.5 years. And we'll continue that commitment in Congress.
We need that so deeply. I guess I wanted to ask you, you know, how do you think Democrats can lead on these issues around peace? You know, you see and have seen Trump, even from 2016, pay this lip service to, you know, the Iraq war was stupid. I mean, for him, it was like it was stupid because it wasn't his war and he didn't take all the treasure. Mm-hmm. As we're now learning, once again, 13 years later, another Republican, administration has taken us to war, this time with Iran. Thanks to the luring of Israel as well. Mm-hmm. And on top of an ongoing genocide that has really been a bipartisan project, at least from this country. How do progressive Democrats, Democratic Socialists, how do they need to lead on this issue? And what would you hope to do in Congress?
Yeah. And in addition to, you know, being a day one co-sponsor on Unblock the Bombs, and really just speaking to the reality that Palestinians are facing right now, not just in Gaza, but in the West Bank too. We've seen a massive increase in settlement activity in violation, an open violation of international law. It's completely unacceptable. And the United States should be following our own laws in addition to international law. We shouldn't be funding an apartheid state, one that's committing human rights violations and genocide. And we need to be speaking really clearly about this. There is no, in my opinion, moral or even legal ambiguity here. The United States mm-hmm. is in violation of international and our own laws. And we have to hold Israel and the Netanyahu government accountable. The Democratic base and Americans have been watching this happen for 2.5 years in real time on our phones. We know what is happening. The Democratic Party refusing to kind of address that and speak to the base is a massive failure on our part.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's political malfeasance. They've dropped the ball. I mean, you and I guess, you know, politicized, active in the anti-war movement. Never did I imagine that the Democrats would, I mean, I guess I should have known, but never did I think that they would be repeating kind of the same mistakes of being like, well, the Ayatollah's got to go, but I've got process questions. I'm obviously doing my Schumer, but how do you feel about something like boycott, divestment, sanctions? You know, I'm really going for that. The word sanctions and Israel just feels cozy to me as someone who doesn't just want to see us not give money to Israel, but like maybe leverage those sanctions against countries that actually are committing human rights violations and not just the ones that we happen to not like at a certain moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I'm supportive. And, you know, BDS is a non-violent movement in the same way that, you know, boycotting has won unions in the past. It's defeated apartheid South Africa. I think we need to be using every avenue to make sure that we're holding Israel accountable and that the United States is not complicit in a genocide.
Yeah. Lastly, you know, I see that you are a dual national of the Native American Isleta del Sur Pueblo in Texas. Mm-hmm. You're from Texas. Mm-hmm. Tell me about how does being Native and part of this, you know, being a dual national, how does it inform your politics?
Yeah, it's, I think it makes me, it does a couple things, I think. Like, it ties me very personally to the fights for self-determination and sovereignty, you know, from Puerto Rico to Palestine. I think it's so essential that we're standing in solidarity in those struggles. And I think it makes me think about immigration in a different way. You know, we hear all these, you know, white conservative men talk about who does and does not belong here. And look, this nation was founded on genocide and the mass displacement of people. It's just the history. And to say that some people cannot belong here, it's like, come on. Like, you know.
You can leave first is what you mean.
You can throw yourself through the door. This is a nation that that should be welcoming people here, that want to come, the people who come here to build better lives and for themselves and their families to deserve real dignity, deserve to stay here. And we should be welcoming them. So it just gives me a different perspective on a few of these issues.
And Native people have been swept up by ICE, which is, you know, the irony of all ironies. Okay. Last. I know you got to go. You're very busy in your campaigning. I do want to talk to you about, you know, this idea of social housing. We're mm-hmm. at this point, you are in a district, you're saying 70% of your, you know, people in your district are renters, if not more. And, you know, we're in a moment, everyone's talking about the housing crisis, and yet no one's actually talking about what is causing the housing mm-hmm. crisis, yep. which really is the ridiculous whims of a cutthroat BS market, if you ask me, that's pricing people out for no reason. What is the Homes Act that AOC is sponsored in the House? How do you hope to, you know, bolster that? I mean, and what is social housing? What should Americans know about that?
Yeah, so I'll start with social housing is deeply affordable. It's managed by the people who actually live in it, democratically managed by them, and it's insulated from market forces. So it can look like a lot of different things. It can look like NYCHA here in New York City. It can look like Mitchell-Lamaco. It can look like a lot of different things. But the most important thing is that it's permanently affordable and that it's being advanced by the state, and it's pushing back against the corporate interests who make our rents so high. You know, especially in New York City, the real estate industry has such a hold on our political processes, on our politicians, and social housing is one way to kind of advance a vision that says, actually, our homes are our homes. They're not portfolio investments for the wealthy and powerful. So the Holmes Act is carried by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez at the federal level. It would introduce investments for social housing. It also put money into our NYCHA developments and repeal something called the Faircloth Amendment that has capped the amount of public housing that we can build. So there's a few things that it does. I know. Well, it's because of the real estate industry, you know, like these people don't want to see public housing built because they're supposed to be making money off of this. Public housing is one way that people can stay in their homes and have real dignity and stability in their lives and not get captured by these like incredibly wealthy real estate developers.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And again, I feel like there needs to be an answer. You know, Trump is sort of like making these inroads talking about, well, he doesn't think that private equity should be, you know, buying up so many rental units and all this. And it's like, again, even a broken clock, right, is right. And even it's really horrible to see the Democratic Party sometimes get outflanked by just kind of lip service, no real action, but lip service from people like Trump. And that's how he won. And I think that's the last thing I'll say is, you know, I feel like Zohran Mamdani really has been able to acknowledge that actually there is some kind of populist sauce that Donald Trump has. I mean, it is disgusting. Don't touch it. But like, you know, that he's like, that's how they were able, you know, he was able to make inroads into New York voters. And that's what I, you know, I wanted to answer to. And so to me, I feel like we need people like yourself who understand these issues and are not afraid to like, again, name the enemy, name the corporate landlords.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. No, it's shameful that the Democrats aren't leading on these issues. You know, these are real people's lives. We're really being squeezed right now, especially in New York City. And there are solutions to this. We can be leaders in this right now. We just need the political will.
Absolutely. Claire Valdez, thank you so much for being here. Where can people get involved, donate, knock doors? I mean, man, if you're listening to this, I know you're in Claire's district. I'm my friend. I'm going to text them right now. My whole group chat is in your district.
You can go to ClaireValdezForCongress.com, sign up to Canvas. We're out. We've got 14 shifts every week, 1,300 volunteers. You can be one of them. Join us.
Amazing. Yes. The weather's nice. It's time to knock doors, get to know your neighbors and tell them about Claire. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank
Take care.
Thank you so much.
Best of luck. All right, everybody. You know what to do. You go to Claire Valdez for Congress. You donate. You sign up. You volunteer. Do all the things. And have I not brought you just the best people in the world? And I, my God, I'm so excited for when she wins this seat. We need it. We need someone we need someone to tell Hakeem Jeffries off. I mean, if just one more person to tell Hakeem Jeffries off. Thank you guys for joining me for Candidate Corner. Go to the playlist on YouTube. There's a bunch of other candidates you should know about. Watch those, get involved, and send me suggestions on people you think I should interview. Until next time, fight the power, fuck the patriarchy, free Palestine, and don't just bitch about it, be about it. Bye-bye.